I am Dominique Costaliola. I am senior researcher at INSERM, working at Institut Pierre-Louis d'Épidémiologie et de Santé Publique from Sorbonne University and INSERM. On behalf of my missing co-chair, Thomas Bourgeron, from Institut Pasteur and Université Diderot, bienvenue à tous. And without further ado, we will begin with the first session. The session is supposed to be around 30 minutes talks, and then we will have time for discussion with the audience. So the first speaker will be Jonathan Marchini, and as Arnaud just said, he will present us the UK Biobank. Jonathan.
Well, thank you very much. I'd just like to say I'm really happy to be here. It's great to be back in Europe. I recently moved to America, so it's great to be back in Europe. So as Arno said, I'm going to start talking about the UK Biobank, really try to set the scene for the rest of the session and the day. UK Biobank, not showing. Okay. So what I'm going to try to do is tell you about Biobank, the design of the study, and give you an overview of the data that's available. It's a huge amount of data. I want to try to give you a flavour of what's there and what you can get access to. My involvement in this project has been involving the analysis of the genetic data, so I'm going to introduce that. Tell you about some aspects of that data to do with the population structure or ancestry of the individuals in the study, how related they are, to a little bit about some of the statistical work that we've done to improve the data, and how we go about doing a genome-wide association study. Then I'm going to go dive a bit deeper into some of the really interesting phenotype data, specifically the brain imaging data that's been collected on a large is being collected on a large subset of the 500,000 people. And then very briefly talk about the ongoing effort to exome sequence all of the 500,000 samples. And this is, I now work for a company called Regeneron who are leading the way in that. So what is the UK Biobank? Well, it's a phenomenal major resource aimed at improving the prevention, diagnosis and treatment of disease. So, you know, there really was an amazing amount of foresight, maybe 15 years ago, to start collecting data on 500,000 men and women across the UK aged between 40 and 69. And the data, as I'll say more in subsequent slides, it's extensive, detailed baseline questions that were given to each individual when they visited the assessment centre, as well as collection of biological samples for future assays. And this is all within the National Health Service, which is, in the UK, quite a unique endeavour. So it's the largest group of people anywhere in the world in one single health system, and it keeps detailed records on those individuals as they go through their lives. So the idea of collecting 500,000 people was to then follow them through to see what happens to them through their life and link health records to the genetic data and other data sets. So the amazing thing about this is it's available reasonably straightforward to any person who's an academic or a commercial researcher worldwide. If you have a bona fide research question, then you can make an application. You have to pay a fee to get the data, but normally that's reasonably straightforward. So it's a huge resource, and I think is extremely well accessible. So as I said, it's a prospective study, and so there are some advantages of doing a prospective study. So it allows a wide range of conditions to be studied. You don't have to specify a particular disease of interest and go out and collect people with that disease. You can just collect a large number of people and watch what happens to them. Exposures can be assessed prior to disease development, which can be very useful. You're not then asking people to recall what happened in their past, having got a particular disease. It allows you to investigate factors that might be affected by disease processes. It allows you to assess those conditions that can't be easily investigated retrospectively. So fatal conditions, and it can include all those cases that have high fatality rates, for example, myocardial infarction. And then, of course, it's relatively straightforward to compare controls selected from within the cohort to specific subsets of cases. So, as I said, the nice thing about the study is you don't have to pick a particular disease of interest. You can just see what happens to the people as they progress, but you do essentially have to wait. And so through time, for each disease, you will expect the increasing numbers of people with disease. And so there was a paper published in 2015 that tried to estimate roughly how many cases we might expect for a range of reasonably common diseases. And so you can see, you know, we're somewhere in between here now. We can expect in the next few years to get rather large numbers of cases over a full spectrum of diseases. And these numbers are getting quite big. And that means we have a lot of power, statistical power, to make novel discoveries about those diseases. So I'll dig a little bit deeper into what is available on these individuals. So every individual, when they visited the assessment centre, they had to do a touchscreen survey. And this survey covered all of these different factors, so sleep, alcohol, diet, smoking, physical activity, early life factors, general health. So it's a very comprehensive questionnaire. It took a median of 52 minutes to do for each person. So it's quite a time commitment. There was also standard baseline measures were taken on each of the individuals, so blood pressure, heart rate, their height was measured, waist hip circumference, their weight, spirometry, ultrasound, and then they also were interviewed, a one-to-one, a very short interview, maybe 4 minutes, to assess their medical history, their occupation, and some other factors. And then there has been, subsequent to that, follow-up collections on subsets of individuals. So between 100 and 200,000 people took part in web-based questionnaires, diet diaries, lifetime occupation, cognitive function. 100,000 people were given accelerometers, wrist accelerometers, to wear for a week to measure their physical activity. Lipids, metabolites were measured in a standard panel of assays on actually all 500,000 people, and that data has recently been released. There's an ongoing effort to collect imaging data on 100,000 people, brain, heart, body, MRI, and then bone and joint and DEXA scans. Hearing tests, visual tests, retinal images, OCT images, and then, of course, the genetic data, whole genome genotyping on all 500,000 individuals. So this data, you have to apply to access it, but there's a website that you can go to. The title, you can see the web address there if you're interested. It's very straightforward to browse what is available. So I've prepared this little video that just shows you. You can search, you can type in something like blood pressure. Then you get a list of every instance in the data. It says blood pressure, so I've clicked on diastolic, and then you can see you get some summary. It tells you that there are this many data points on blood pressure covering nearly all 500,000 individuals, and you get some small amount of summary information about that trait. And so it's very useful to be able to browse through this to see what is in the data before you make an application. So you can see what's there. So I'm going to talk about the genetic data, and I'm going to assume not everybody knows about genetics. So I've got a little cartoon here, really, to try to represent what's been collected. So here, each row is a person, and each column is a position in the genome. And so here I only have four people, and I have seven positions. In reality, there are going to be 500,000 rows, and there are going to be about 800,000 positions of the genome that have been measured. Now, the genome is a very large place. It's 3.2 billion positions. Yeah? It's very difficult or expensive to collect data on all of those positions. And over time, we've worked out that if you collect a kind of roughly equally spaced number of positions, that is extremely valuable information in order to help you make discoveries about the genetic basis of disease, population genetics, and population structure. So what you get at each position, at each individual, are the two letters, A, C, T, or G, that exist at that position. And of course, you have two copies, one from your mother and one from your father. So this person has an A and a C. This person has an A and an A. So you've got to imagine that matrix just much deeper and much, much longer. And so that was collected by an Affymetrix SNP array. So this is the technology used to collect this data. And a committee was put together essentially to choose those 800 positions very carefully. So there was a big set of positions that were designed to capture the genetic variation as well as possible in the set of individuals. And then specific classes of position or SNP were added. So APOE is a very important position in the genome. It's a locus that has a very big effect on your risk of developing Alzheimer's. There's specific sets of coding variants. So these are positions within genes that we know make coding changes to proteins. And then various other sets of variants known to be associated with particular diseases, SNPs in regions like the HLA, which are very important for immune function. So that data was collected, and then we started to look at it. And one of the first things we started to look at was population structure. So can we use the genetic data to make inferences about the genetic ancestry? Essentially, where are these people from? What is their genetic ancestry? And so the first thing that we did was we applied a method called PCA, which takes that big matrix of genotype data and tries to find a two-dimensional representation of that data. So the data itself is highly dimensional. Can we find, essentially, the best way of arranging all those 500,000 people on a 2D plane that represents as much variation in that data set as possible? So this is the plot that you get. You get this first axis and the second axis. And then each point has been colored according to where each person self-reported they were from. Okay? And that's not always the same as their genetic ancestry. So you can see that there is the largest amount of people are from here. You know, this was a collection from the UK. So most of the people, you can see British, actually it's not super clear, but green crosses, which was annotated as self-reported British, which is about 430,000 people. Most of these people cluster very strongly here. And then you can see there's variation away from there. All of these people here have self-reported ancestry from Africa, and then there's individuals here who self-report East Asian ancestry. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that this cohort is quite diverse from around the world. There are lots of people with diverse ancestries in this data set. And you can see some of the numbers of self-reported ancestry. And doing this type of analysis is actually very important when you go on to try to make genetic discoveries, because you have to account for where people are from in the world, what their genetic ancestry is, to avoid making false inferences. The other thing we looked at is relatedness. You can take the genetic data from two individuals and compare that and make an inference of how closely related they are. So if I was in that data set and my brother was in that data set, because we share so much DNA, those two rows of that matrix, to some extent, would look similar. So we can measure that and then make an inference. So when it's a close relative, like a parent or a brother or a cousin, you can infer that very well. And so we were able to count essentially how many pairs of individuals fell into different classes. So we found that there were 186 pairs of twins, over 6,000 parent offspring pairs. I mean, these individuals were between 40 and 69. So it is feasible that within that age range, two people could be parent offspring. Of course, lots of siblings. And then as you go further in terms of how related they are, the numbers increase. So there is, overall, we found 148,000 individuals in the data set who were in a, had a genetic relationship to at least one other person. So that's quite a lot of relatedness in that data set. And we did some calculations were done to say, how is this expected? And roughly, we think this is more relationship than you'd expect if you took a completely random sample. And that's because it wasn't a completely random sample. People were, I think one of the issues is people were asked if they wanted to be in the study. And so there's an effect. If I say I'm going to be in the study, I might tell my close relatives about this study I've been part of, and they might then, when they get invited, think it's a good thing. And so that increases how the amount of relatedness. This picture shows some of those family structures that we found in the data. So you can see that these little pairs of individuals, but then as you link them together, you can see that there's some more extended families in the data. So here you've got a trio, and that might be a parent and two children. And you've got four people here. This might be a parent and three children. And here, this might be four siblings altogether. So one of the things I worked on this data was trying to enhance the genetic data. So as I said, there are 800,000 positions in the genome that were measured. But there, as I said also, there are 3.2 billion positions in the whole genome. So this is actually, even though it's a large number, it's still quite a small fraction of the total positions I can measure. Ideally, I would want all 3.2 billion. And so the question is, what can we say about all of those other positions that weren't directly measured? And so there's a method that I've worked on quite a lot in my career called imputation that allows you to probe those positions without actually going and measuring them. So I want to explain how that works. So this is my cartoon where I have this matrix of genotype data. The first thing we do to the data is we estimate the phase or the haplotypes in this data. As I said before, each individual has two of these letters. One comes from their mother, one comes from their father. So if I look along a person, ideally I'd like to say this combination of letters came from the person's mother and this from the father. And so ideally I'd like to arrange the data like this, where all of these letters are arranged on two lines according to the maternal and the paternal transmission. Now that's tricky because if you take a position like this, there's a T and a C, that T and a C can be, you can see I'm switching it can be two ways round. Yeah? So every time there's one of these sites which we call heterozygous, there's two possibilities. The problem is there's lots of them. Okay? So all of these positions can be flipped either way. Now there's a huge number of them, so there's more possible combinations than way more than there are atoms in the universe. It's just a much, much larger number. And so from a statistician, the challenge is, can I estimate which way round each of those flips are? Okay. So that might sound like a very hard problem. The reason that it's tractable, especially in a sample size like this, is because of all of that relatedness. Remember I said that there were lots of individuals who were related to each other. So for example, take myself. If I'm in the data set and my brother is in the data set, our genetic data is very similar because we've inherited similar genetic data from our parents. We can use that because if I see a particular string of letters and I look and I see that someone's related to me, I should see exactly the same set of letters. Not across the whole chromosome, but in short stretches. So there'll be short stretches of sequence that are the same in related individuals. And the statistical methods we use try to leverage that signal. And so, remarkably, you can do extremely well. So even though there are a huge number of possible combinations, over a whole chromosome, which is, this is chromosome 20, we can do remarkably well. So each of these lines is an individual, and these individuals have been chosen because we, because of relatedness information, we know what their, what the truth is. So we've got, I've taken a set of individuals where I know the truth, I've tried to estimate their phase, their haplotypes, and can, then I've compared it to the truth. And the way to read this diagram is, when there's a change from dark blue to light blue, or vice versa, that means the method has made an error. So what you're looking for is you're looking for long stretches of a single colour. And so you can see that I think there's 70 individuals on this plot. You can see that many individuals almost have a whole chromosome where you've made perfect inference. This was actually a plot we did back in, I think it must have been 2015 or 16 now, and the methods have actually increased in accuracy since then. So we're able to do very well. We're able to resolve the phase of these individuals very accurately. The next step is then to, as I said, try to fill in the gaps that we haven't measured. And the way that we can do that is using external databases of data. So there are some reference data sets from the Haplotype Reference Consortium, projects like the UK 10K project, that have really taken the time to measure every position using a different technology, genome sequencing. And so there are sets where we've got very fine scale detail about the letters at each position. So we have this reference data, and then we have our UK Biobank data, and then we can try to match up this data to this one. So essentially you can see this person here has lots of missing places. But now I've got these alleles all phased, what I can do is essentially look for matches. So if I take this stretch of sequence here, I can look in my reference database and see, look, well, it matches that stretch there. Okay. And so then I can infer that it's quite likely, because of that match across that region, this person has also those letters in all of the gaps. And so I can then copy down that sequence. I can use these matches to predict down the alleles that are missing. Okay, and so we use statistical models to do that. It's not quite this simple because there's not always a unique match. Yep, and the matches are of different lengths in different individuals. So we use models, hidden Markov models, to account for that. I've given one of our references there. Essentially, what we're trying to do is something like this. We're trying, for each individual, we're trying to match it to match a stretch of sequence to a stretch of sequence here and copy down. So it's like each person is a mosaic of all of the sequences in the reference database. So a lot of my group's time has been spent on making these methods scale, making them as far computationally fast as possible. When we did this in 2016-17, it was taking about 10 minutes per sample with our software Impute4. We've made at least a factor of 10 increase in that now with Impute5. So essentially what we can then do is take that 800,000 set of positions and increase it to 96 million, so over a 100-fold increase in the amount of data that we've got. And then we start looking at phenotypes. So I take my matrix of data, and now I've got 96 million positions, and I take a phenotype of interest, so for example, height, and then I can compare each position and look for an association with that phenotype. So there's a statistical model here. Essentially what I'm looking for, there are three possibilities, AA, AC, and CC. And then when I look at the phenotype in those three classes, what I'm looking for is a signal somewhat like this, where there's an association between the genotype and the phenotype. And so you can fit a statistical model and assess whether these box plots are different, obtain a p-value, and you can do that for all of the positions. And so here's how it works out for height. So this is the whole of chromosome 2. These red dots are positions we already knew were associated with height. Okay, so this is what the literature was telling us before we did this experiment. When I do that test in 10,000 biobank people, I get all of these little black dots. Each one is a position in the genome. And you can see, and the y-axis is minus log 10 p-value. And the red line is where I start to get excited about a signal. You can see there's not much going on. There's something maybe slightly going on here. It's because I've only got 10,000. And this is where the power of biobank really comes in. If I go to 150,000, you can see now I'm starting to get some signals all across the chromosome. So it's saying that there are many positions across chromosome 2 that are influencing our height. Then I go to 350,000, you can see it gets even better. And then when I add in the imputation, so go from 800,000 to 96 million, it looks like this. So I think this really clarifies to me the value. You can see that the resolution massively increases. It's a lot easier to see which positions are associated. Height's a special case, I think, in some sense. There's lots of positions in the genome that affect our height. Essentially, our height is the combination of lots of parts of our body, all which have a genetic basis, individual genetic basis maybe, and so it's all adding up. We can then look at one particular, if I look at this particular region, you can see there was no red dot, so it's a novel region. This is what it looks like. And this is before imputation. When I add imputation, which are the grey dots, you can see the resolution is increasing, and actually the signal is increasing. And it's implicating maybe a different gene than what would be implicated without imputation. So I'm running out of time.
No, it's fine. You still have 5 minutes or more, okay. Or even more. So.
I wanted to say a little bit about the brain imaging. So as I said earlier, 100,000 people are being imaged. I think at the moment it's about 35,000. They're doing about 20,000 people a year. And it's heart, brain, heart, and body imaging. And I think the effort has already started actually to get a second time point on 10,000 people. And so, large number of different brain imaging modalities are applied to each individual. Now, there's a whole talk here on what we do with that brain imaging data to process it into something we can use. So when you measure someone's height, that's a very simple measure. Yeah, but when you take a brain image of someone, that image essentially is millions of data points. So there's not one single number like height, there's millions of numbers. So ideally, you need to turn it into a smaller set of numbers that are meaningful. So there's a whole image processing suite of tools that's applied to the images that measure things like volumes of particular parts of the brain, like the hippocampus, the putamen, the amygdala, or they measure the amount of gray matter you have. And they measure the connection strength between different parts of the brain. So this table really is trying to summarize all of those different measures that are derived from the brain imaging. So for example, this one here, this T2 flare Bianca phenotype, it's measuring total white matter hyperintensity. That's a long way of saying it's measuring the amount of lesions that a person has in their brain. Okay. So if we're interested in genetic basis of lesions in the brain, we pick that measure, and there's one of those. But then you can see in other classes, so there's this one, T1 first, which is 7 subcortical volumes. So this is the volume of the putum and the volume of the amygdala, the hippocampus, and so on. And then you've got these are partial grey matter volumes of different parts of the cortex. There are these measures here which measure white matter microstructure. And then actually part of the imaging is through time. Image somebody through time, you can measure the connection strength of different parts of their brain. So there's a huge number of measures, actually, over half, that are related to that. So in total, there were 3,144 individual measures that were defined from the imaging. Now, we analysed each of those individually using a genome-wide scan. I can't, as I said, there's a whole other talk to describe the results, but here's one particular result. This is the genome-wide scan across all 22 chromosomes. So my slide's been cut off, but this is for a T2 star measurement, which measures venous vasculature, microbleeds, and microstructure in a particular part of the brain called the putamen. And you can see we found lots of genome-wide hits. Remember that line there is where I get interested. This second line is where I get very interested. You can see we found many discoveries across the genome that control that. When we dig back down into the images, and we can look at, in fine resolution, each of these major 4 positions seem to be highlighting different parts of the putamen. So even within that small structure, the genetic variants are having localized effects. I'll skip over that. We've put, and this is happening more and more, I think, making the results publicly available. So people can browse very quickly. My current colleague at Regeneron, Gonzalo Abacasis, and his team built this amazing software that allows you to browse the results of such studies. I've got this little video that shows you that. So this is a web browser. You can put in a particular phenotype of interest, and it will then show you in real time that genome-wide scan. It will then show you some summary information. It will show you the major hits. You can then click on particular regions. When you click on them, takes a little bit of time, you get the zoomed in picture. So then you can look very quickly then what genes are in that region. And then when you click on a particular position, it will show you that position in all of those phenotypes. So you can see if that position, it's not only associated with that trait, it's associated with a whole range of different traits. And these tools are becoming more and more widely used. The amount of data is getting so big, and it's not just one phenotype like height that we're measuring, it's many. So it's very helpful to dig deeper and make discoveries. There are some kind of funny things in this data set as well. This is the search tool that we added to the browser. And then there's some interesting traits like how much you nap during the day. And if you do a genome-wide scan of that, you can see there are lots of positions in the genome that seem to be associated with how often you nap during the day. But I'll leave it to you to go and browse that. So very quickly, just to finish, I'm just going to say a little bit about the exome sequencing. So this is being carried out from the Regeneron Genetics Center, which I now work on all 500,000 subjects. And it's actually a collaboration between Biobank and 8 different pharmaceutical companies, 9 if you include GSK, who were involved in the initial part of the project. So this... What is the exome? Well, it's very focused analysis of the parts of the genome we know are important for making proteins. So if you take a particular gene, it's made up of exons and introns, and it's the exons that come together through the process of transcription and translation to make a particular protein. Of course, these proteins are then important in biological processes. So these exons, when there's a mutation in those exons, that can have a big effect on the protein. So if you get the wrong mutation, then the protein can be either completely degraded, or it doesn't even get made, or it doesn't function properly, or its shape is changed. And so the reason that the genetic data that was initially collected, it doesn't capture all of the mutations in these regions. You have to use another technology, exome sequencing, to capture every single mutation. Now, the exome is about 1 to 2% of the genome. So it's a small part of the genome, but you have to look at it very intently. It's quite expensive. And so that's why, you know, these companies have had to come together to fund that. It is quite an endeavor. And so, you know, we are analyzing that data. In-house at the moment, we have 150,000 people exome sequenced, but we recently published a paper. It's freely available on 50,000 individuals. Just to give you a brief flavor of that, we identified 4 million positions that had a mutation in those 50,000. So you remember the data I first described was 800,000 positions, yeah, across the genome. Just in this 1 to 2% of the genome, we found 4 million positions that have some measure of variation. So you can see when you apply the new technology, you really do find a lot more positions that have variation. So interestingly, nearly every gene, yeah, we were able to find an individual who had a mutation that changed the function of that gene. And in most genes, nearly 70%, we were able to find 10 people, more than 10 people who had a mutation which changed the function of that protein. We call them LOFs, loss of function. There are also particular mutations we already know about that are, to some extent, actionable. Okay? You can do something about them. So there are mutations in the BRCA genes, which are important for increasing your risk of breast cancer. LDLR, which increases your risk for familial hypercholesterolemia. PMS2 and KCNQ1 are also important variants. And we were able to, if we look at those particular variants, we found 2% of individuals out of the 500,000 people had a mutation that they probably want to know about, because they could do something about it, yeah. And so I think that's maybe going to be discussed later on. You know, should these people be told about these mutations that they have? Because currently, no data is returned to the participants. So I'll stop there. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. You know, the web resources for the project are really great, so I'd encourage you to there was a URL at the top, but it's been cut off. But there's lots of resources. There's an annual meeting every year. They video the talks. You can watch them, learn more about all the different parts of the project. I'll stop there.
Thank you.